Hello, everyone. Thanks very much for attending, at least virtually, this talk. And thank you very much to the organizers of the Postgres Dev Room at FOSDEM for having me. My name is Christoph Pettis. I'm with a boutique Postgres consultancy in San Francisco, California, called PostgreSQL Experts. And normally this time of year, we'd be in Brussels attending FOSDEM, but circumstances being as we are, we're doing this remotely. And today we're going to talk about database disasters and how to find them, specifically Postgres-related database problems and how you respond to them productively. I'm going to give a little story here about something that happened to me. Day was nice day out on the bay, and I was asked by a client to do one job. We had a production database server running as a primary, and we wanted to move that from one Amazon instance to another. They were increasing the instance size. Wanted to minimize downtime, very busy, high traffic site using streaming replication. This is a very easy job in Postgres. Is you set up the primary, you have a secondary, a binary replica, you quiesce the application, wait for replication on the secondary to catch up, decommission the primary, promote the secondary to being the new primary, and you're done. That's it. What could go wrong with a process like this? It's extraordinarily simple. Well, we did that, and then 36 hours later, I get a call and weird things are happening. For example, in rows that were in the old primary were just not in the new primary. They were gone. There were deleted rows in the old primary that were still on the new primary. Even weirder. And worse yet, rows that were in the primary were duplicated. The old primary were duplicated on the new primary. Doing so violated primary key constraints, but the indexes were still reflected both entries. And we couldn't figure out what was going on. There were multiple versions of the same row before and after modification. There was a timestamp on each row. And newly created rows that were on the old primary had never been pushed over to the secondary that was now serving as the new primary. Okay, so we did a little bit of diagnosis and we were sure we'd found it, which is the tables had a last modified timestamp so we could tell when each row had been modified. And all the bad rows were clustered right around the cutover time. And we discovered that, in fact, the application hadn't been quiesced. It was running right up until the last moment. So that must be it. There were active queries at the cutover time, and that was the source of the problem. Now, if you know anything about Postgres, and you're not in the middle of a crisis like we were, you're probably thinking, wait, that doesn't actually make sense. How could corruption like that happen with something like that? And you'd be right. But we didn't think of that because we were in this mad hurry to get the site fixed and back up. So we couldn't roll back to the old primary because there had been changes that we didn't want to lose on the new primary, but we could fix the database. So we did a PG dump and a PG restore, patched up everything very, very tediously, brought it back up, and we were very proud of ourselves. The problem was solved. All the rows were correct now. We brought up a new secondary to make sure there were no queries running this time, and everything looked great. So we declared victory. Everybody went home, signed off this call at 3 in the morning. And then at 9 a.m., Christoph, the problem was occurring again on the new secondary. The exact same problem, same symptoms. Duplicated rows, rows that were deleted on the primary were still visible on the secondary, all sorts of things. But the reason we were sure this problem had occurred was gone. So, oh no, now what? What's going on? So what happened? Actually, it was a Postgres bug, a replication bug. Long since fixed. You don't have to worry about it on any system you're running now. We downgraded to an earlier minor release and waited till the next minor release came up, which fixed the problem, and we upgraded. Problem solved. The biggest problem here is when I was actually responding to the problem, I pretty much did everything wrong. I didn't keep the parts. I was making changes directly to the live database in a way that could not easily be rolled back. I didn't work up the stack and look consistently at what the problem was, and I didn't methodically track down the error, and I allowed my desire to instantly fix a particular problem to override the fact that the fix that I thought was happening couldn't actually be the problem. And very early I decided it couldn't be a Postgres bug, because how often does Postgres have bugs? And the answer is not frequently, but in this particular case it was. So we're going to talk about what to do when disaster strikes. Poor airplane. I feel so sad for that. So you get a call, 3 in the morning, bad things are happening. The CPU is pegged, or you're out of disk space, or you think there's data corruption, or there are lock pileups. And when you get one of these calls, the first step is to stop. Take a deep breath and pause. Because what a crisis is really a problem with panic. You is a problem that has been escalated to a crisis because people are panicking and trying to fix it without really thinking through what the problem is. The first thing you need to do is do no harm. You're down. Take a deep breath, move cautiously. This is surprisingly important to minimize communication channels. Especially in larger organizations, there is this psychology that the only reason a problem is ever fixed is somebody with a lofty enough title hasn't yelled at the engineer yet. So the director will say, well, I'm a director. If I yell, it'll work. And that doesn't work because the problem's not easily fixed. And so now a vice president will yell at the engineer, and that should fix it. It's important to minimize the communication channels. And if you have a team working on this, designate one person who will communicate to the outside world about it and not have everybody's phone or Slack channel going off at the same time. Don't delete anything unless you know that is the solution to the problem. A lot of the crises and serious data corruption that we deal with here at PGX occur because somebody logged in, saw that it was out of disk space, deleted something they shouldn't have, and now they have two problems. For example, if you run out of disk space and it's full of the text logs in Postgres, deleting those is a great thing to do because it clears up a lot of disk space, you're done. But I mean text logs. For example, a call that unfortunately we get to this day is the disk filled up, so we deleted the log files, and now Postgres won't start. And I'll ask, what did you delete? And they say everything in the log directory, and I say, which log directory? And they'll say PG underscore xlog. Is that bad? Yes. In fact, it's so bad and so common that in more recent versions of Postgres, PG underscore xlog was renamed PG wall so that people wouldn't think it's a log that could be easily deleted. Unfortunately, people still do. So, no accounting. So now let's talk about some bad situations that can occur in a Postgres database and kind of what things to think about to respond to them. One problem with this is every bad server is bad in its own way. There's really no bounded set of these are the problems that can occur, this is how you respond. So to a certain extent, you have to just build up experience and Google fast about what each problem is. But we can give you some ideas about what really common ones is and first places to look. So the first one we're going to talk about is the CPU pegging. This is a real graph, by the way, is that everything was running fine down around what does that look like 7% CPU? And then suddenly, wham, in the course of less than a second, every CPU gets occupied at 100%. This is normalized across all vCPUs, which makes me wonder why it goes up to 120, but whatever. So here are the things to look at. One possible reason for CPU pegging on Postgres is a connection storm. Every new connection that Postgres requires a backend process to be fired up, which requires a fork. Forking in Linux is a very high CPU process. Now, forking a single process is not so bad, but if you're forking hundreds of them at the same time, for example, you go from 20 connections to 500 connections over the course of a second, your CPU is going to go rather crazy. And this is not uncommon. It's especially bad if the connections are opening and closing fast. So you're getting, not only are you getting a very, very a large number of connections opening at the same time, but then they're closing and reopening. For example, some stacks will, by default, open and close a connection on every web request, so you can get really bad problems there. So the first thing to do when you're resolving this is don't do that. The best thing to do is add a pooler like PG Bouncer into the stack. This may not be something you can do in an emergency, but it's the right. But anticipating this and putting that in, you can do that to moderate the number of connections that will be open at any one time to the server and to reduce the connection overhead by eliminating the very, very fast connection open close. These problems often occur because of thundering herd problems, mass cache reinvalidation. For example, sometimes pushing out a new version of the application will cause a mass cache invalidation. All these processes wake up and try and rebuild the cache from the database, and things go south. Sometimes you're using a pooler, but you're still getting this problem of very, very fast connection open and close because the queries are getting errors that you can see in the text logs that are causing the connection on the server side to be forcibly closed, and that drops the back end, and now it has to be reopened. Another common reason for this are bad query plans. What will happen is a previously benign query, a very simple one, and that's being done a lot, and only takes milliseconds to run, 1 or 2 milliseconds, suddenly we'll start having a really bad plan. So like a something that was normally an index scan would suddenly become an index heap and bitmap scan because Postgres, for whatever reason, changes the plan underneath you, even as the queries themselves haven't changed much. This is very often caused by tables and indexes getting badly bloated, especially on high update rate tables. The indexes will slowly build up dead tuples over and over again. Indexes especially, it's hard for vacuum to reclaim those dead tuples. And at some point, Postgres will decide the index is so badly bloated that it can't really use it, or if it does use it, it does an index bitmap and heap scan instead. To fix these, first thing, the most important thing is making sure AutoVacuum is keeping up. Don't disable AutoVacuum on busy tables. Tune it so that it doesn't take too much resources instead. Frequently, you'll have to do, on high update rate tables, you'll have to do manual vacuum operations. And while manual can, in this case, mean literally logging in with PSQL and typing vacuum, I also mean using a cron job or some other kind of scheduler to do vacuum operations that aren't auto vacuum to forcibly keep up with a very high insert and modification rate. And you can rebuild badly bloated indexes on very recent versions of PostgreSQL. There's a re-index concurrently operation. Older versions, you can build an identical parallel index and drop the old one to get the same effect. There's a Postgres extension, PG Repack, which does the equivalent of a vacuum full operation without having to take a long full lock on the table. And this can be very valuable for applications that have very high insert rates update rates or deletions from a very large table. So repacking this on a periodic basis, sometimes even daily, can be very, very helpful. Okay, next situation, you run out of disk space. Everybody's done this, you know, disk space goes away. So one of the first things to look at is, where is this disk space gone? Use df or du, if that's what it takes, to find out where on the database volume the disk space is getting tight. One thing you'll often find is wall pileups, especially for very, very sudden, fast buildups in wall. This is in disk space, this is one of the first places to look is, has the write-ahead log sort of gotten out of control and is building up very, very fast? Write-ahead log segments not being recycled by PostgreSQL. So PostgreSQL normally will try and keep the amount of wall it's using down to around max wall size, which is a PostgreSQL.conf parameter. But sometimes it won't. And there are a variety of reasons that it will start retaining more wall than that. For example, archive command could fail. The archive command is used to ship wall files off of the server, generating them for backup and purposes, or to send them to a secondary. If it starts failing, returning a non-zero status back to Postgres, Postgres will decide, okay, I better retain this wall file because I don't want to throw it away until it's been successfully archived. A very common cascading failure is a secondary will run out of disk space. The archive command is pushing wall files over to that secondary. It now starts getting an error because it's getting it out of disk space on the secondary. Now it starts failing, and suddenly the primary is starting to run out of disk space. Very embarrassing. Try not for this not to happen. Fortunately, you can go into the error logs on Postgres and see, the archive command is not working, and you can fix it. When logical replications was introduced, we got also named logical replication slots, and this gave us a whole new way of running out of disk space. A named logical replication slot is basically a named object in the primary that retains, among other things, the position in the wall that the logical replication slot has, the logical replication client has received. So once it's created, Postgres will not recycle any wall files until it knows those are no longer needed. for the logical replication slot. Unfortunately, this means the client could disconnect, go away forever, and wall just keeps piling up and piling up and piling up. In very recent versions of Postgres, version 13 in particular, you can set a limit to how much wall it will pile up, at which point it will just start, it'll stop, throw everything away, start throwing things away, and you'll and to reclaim this space. Earlier versions of Postgres don't have this. This is a very common failure mode for logical replication. So, you fix the underlying issue, whichever it is. Fix archive command if it's not if it's failing. Drop the bad replication slot. Sometimes you just have to do that, is drop it and decide how you want to get the logical replication client that's connected back in sync. Once it's done this, it can require a checkpoint or two to start for disk space to start going back down. So you may need to be a little patient, and so disk space will not instantly drop back down to, and the wall consumption will not instantly drop down back down to max wall size. Another possible reason running out of disk space is text log bloat. Text logs can get really big. For example, if you set log min statement duration to zero, so you're logging every single query that happens, you're getting a lot of great data about what queries you're running, but you're also generating at least one line in the text logs for every single query. Obviously, this could be a very large amount of data. Some systems, specifically RDS, Amazon RDS, the only place you can put the text logs is on the same volume that holds the database. So you can choke the database volume, both in terms of I/O and in terms of the number of text logs. It's not uncommon, for example, that suddenly some kind of very common error will start occurring, duplicate key violation, missing column name, a lot of things. Those are always, unless you specifically disable them by default, they're always logged to the Postgres text logs. And suddenly, the first sign you see of this kind of thing happening is the text log size starting to grow very, very fast to gigabytes upon gigabytes. In this case, you know, reduce the chattiness. Decrease the per query log volume, you know, bump up max logs, log min statement duration if that's required. Move the logs to a separate volume if you want them to be very chatty. Move to a remote collector, rsyslog or something like that. And fortunately, it's safe to delete these. The other thing to do, of course, is if you see these are happening because of high error volume, fix the error. Okay, lock pileups. And lock pileups can come in several different flavors. What tends to happen is the system will appear to have stopped or not responding back to the application, the database system. The number one most common reason for this is migrations, doing schema changes, which of course are a normal part of operation. Nothing wrong with doing a schema change, but schema changes generally require exclusive locks. Adding a column, dropping a column, adding a new table does take exclusive locks on some system catalogs, but of course nothing's actually using the table, so on rows of the table, so those problems. But column modifications in general will take an exclusive lock on the table. It won't take it for very long. It will only take it for long enough to update the particular row. In older versions of Postgres, if you added a new column to a table with a default, Postgres would rewrite the entire table to add the default value in. More recent versions of Postgres optimize that and effectively have a secondary table where the default value is stored, and it just adds the new column as null and grabs the default value on demand. So that's a significant improvement. Another thing that can take a long time is, for example, dropping a not null constraint. If you have a null column that was created as nullable and you set it to not null, Postgres has to scan the entire table to make sure that you're not lying to it, that there really are no non-null values in the table, null values in the table, so it can then enforce the constraint. One way around that is rather than set the column explicitly not null, is to create a check constraint of check column is not null, but mark it as not valid. Postgres will enforce it on any new row insertions or on updates, but it won't go back and look for old values. You can then use the alter table validate constraint command to validate the constraint, which doesn't require an exclusive lock on the table. So that's one way around these. One reason these can be particularly bad is Postgres is a first-in, first-out system for lock grants. They're always queued up strictly in request order. No one can jump the queue. One of the things this means is that even very fast exclusive locks can appear to take the system down. And the way this happens is on a very busy table, there are a lot of queries running. You issue the alter table command to add a column or something like that. It queues up behind all of these very busy things, and these can just be selects that they can be very simple operations. New operations then queue up behind that request for the exclusive lock. Those operations won't be fulfilled until that alter table manages to get the front of the lock queue, perform its operation, and get out again. During that period, while it's working its way up to the front of the queue, in effect, that table is now blocked for new transactions, and this can give the appearance of a permanent lock on very long running shutdown type lock on that table, even though that exclusive lock has not yet been granted. So again, schema change waits, other sessions pile up behind it. So to resolve this, first, if you're in an emergency, cancel that alter table and deal with it later. First, minimize migrations that have to do full table scans or writes so that you do not take a busy table down during a high traffic period. If you must do these, do them during low load periods. If you have to rewrite a giant table, you may have to take a maintenance window to do that. Another possible reason for lock pileups are long-running transactions. All locks that a single transaction takes are held until the end of that transaction. There's no unlock command in Postgres. There's one tiny exception of advisory locks, but those aren't important now. So every transaction will slowly accrue locks as it runs until it commits or rolls back, at which point it releases all the locks. A long-running transaction can, especially one that updates a lot of rows and thus is locking all those rows or touches a lot of tables, can build up a lot of locks. So you have to be careful about these long-running transactions because they can accrue a lot of locks, which block a lot of other operations. Particularly problematic are idle in transaction sessions. An idle in transaction session is one that's taken a lock, has begun, but has not yet committed, but the client is no longer interacting with the database. So it did a begin, did some kind of operation, and then just stopped talking to the database. You'll see these transiently in Postgres because you just happen to check pgstat activity or some other system view right at the moment that the client happened to be idle. Those are fine. But when you start seeing idle transaction sessions that have been taking seconds or minutes, or worse yet, hours sometimes, since it last talked to the database, these can be very bad because they're holding locks, but things are building up, but they're not going to release them anytime soon. So here what you need to do is reduce the transaction length. Fix your idle in transaction sessions. Ultimately, idle in transaction is a client-side problem, not an application-side problem. You can forcibly terminate idle in transaction sessions in Postgres, and you might consider doing that, although doing it database-wide can sometimes create problems for clients that legitimately need to do a bunch of operations, then go away, think for a while, and do new operations. But there is a parameter in Postgres to cancel idle in transaction sessions after a timeout. Prepared transactions can be particularly bad about this because a prepared transaction where you're doing a transaction across what they're intended for is when you do a prepared transaction as a two-phase commit because you're coordinating with some other external resource. If you prepare the transaction but never commit it, that can seriously start building up resources, including locks, over time, and that could last a long time, could end up causing a lot of locking to occur. And sometimes you just need to have a really big transaction. For example, you're doing bulk loads or some other kind of operation. In this case, you consider breaking them up into smaller transactions if your application model can tolerate that so that you don't have these giant lock pileups. This can be very handy, for example, if you're backfilling a table. As you're backfilling the table, you're taking a lock on each row as you do the update. The problem is if you do the entire table, there are a couple of problems. One is ultimately you'll have locked every row on the table and effectively blocked updates on it from any other session. You're also building up quite a bit of garbage. Every time you update a row in Postgres, you're creating a new dead row. Vacuum can't run and clean those up until the transaction that created them commits. So now you have the situation of effectively doubling the disk footprint size of the table. So breaking them up into small sections and vacuuming between them can be very helpful. So there's lots of different kinds of locks in Postgres. What we've been talking about before are sort of relation and heavyweight locks. These are the ones you see in the PG locks system view, where database objects are being locked. There's also a whole class of lightweight locks in Postgres. These are internal locks that are used to protect Postgres data structures. So they don't appear in PG locks. You can see them in PG stat activity, where a process could be waiting on them, though. Postgres has always had them. It's had them since ever. We're starting to hear about them more because previously there was a lot of visibility into things waiting on them, but now we're getting new tools. For example, there's PG Analyze, there's Performance Insights on RDS. So these lightweight locks have become more visible, so we're hearing about them more. So I don't think that we're really like waiting on lightweight locks anymore than we used to, although there is some of that because Postgres is being, instances tend to be now have higher concurrency than they used to, 500, 1,000 connections kind of thing. There's no one technique for all of them. I'm going to talk about the two most common that we see. The first one is wall-write lock. It's held while wall segments are being written to disk. It's basically keeps that wall segment from being cleaned up in memory until all the data is out on disk. Frequently, this happens just because of too much I/O, that things are backing up on the I/O channel, and there's just a lot of processes start to waiting for their ability to write out wall. One way you can help with this is increasing wall buffers. Wall buffers is a setting in PostgreSQL that it dedicates a fixed amount of shared memory for space to queue up wall for the wall writer. So if you're seeing a lot of wall write lock activity, you can bump it up. The maximum you can bump it up to is 2 megabytes. That's not a huge amount of shared memory on modern systems, so consider doing that. So another thing you can do that can rather magically make this go away, although it has a cost, is turning off synchronous commit. If you turn off synchronous commit, the commit statement will not wait until the write-ahead log for its changes have been flushed to disk. It'll just return to the client immediately and keep going. This can significantly improve your throughput because the clients aren't waiting for the wall to be written. There is a downside, and you do have to be aware of this, which is if this database crashes while there's unwritten wall queued up, when the system restarts, transactions that the application thinks have been committed, it issued a commit, the commit returned, everything is fine, could be missing from the underlying disk image, that is, so not part of the database anymore. It's not database corruption. The database isn't corrupt in that sense. It's just farther back in time. So you'll be seeing the database like a second or a few milliseconds before that. So you need to be aware of that and make sure that's acceptable. You can also turn synchronous commit on and off on a per transaction basis if you want using the set statement. Another one we're seeing more and more is proc array lock. If you see things building up on proc array lock, this often means that there are too many concurrent sessions committing at the same time. This probably means is you're pushing your database server too hard. You have too many active connections at the same time trying to do stuff on Postgres, and this internal data structure is becoming the bottleneck. This is a great sign that it's time to reduce concurrency with a pooler and start queuing up connections in the pooler rather than allowing them to feed through the database and kind of pound the poor database to death. One of the reasons that you often see this is concurrency failures are often nonlinear, is that everything will be running fine at 100 connections, then at 120 connections, suddenly throughput drops considerably. Having a pooler that prevents that threshold from being really reached can be very, very helpful. Another one that we see a lot now is buffer content. This is taken while the system is waiting to map a shared buffer, one of these 8K pages that Postgres uses, to the underlying disk page. This is, if you start seeing a lot of waits on this, this is usually a sign that the working set is much larger than shared buffers, that it can't keep the working set in shared buffers enough to properly cache it. This is a good sign that maybe shared buffers is too small, although pragmatically, if you get beyond about 30% of more than about 30% of RAM, you've crossed the point of diminishing returns. So don't bump it up to 90% of RAM or something like that because of these. Also, this can be an indication that just that the underlying I/O channel is getting saturated. So check out your I/O parameters. Okay. Now we're going to get into kind of the worst one, which is data corruption. You start seeing errors like this, which are cryptic and indicate something beyond what you can do to the what a program should be able to do to the database. So, the easiest way to handle data corruption, of course, is restore the last good backup, receive praise, and you're done. Wish this was always going to work. For example, sometimes you just don't have a known good backup, and sometimes even backups that were taken properly and are correct can have hidden long-term corruption, be too old, or be hit by Postgres bugs. That doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. So the first thing to do when dealing with data corruption, in this case I'm talking about a system where you have access to the underlying files. Unfortunately, in a lot of systems like RDS or Azure Postgres, you don't have access to the underlying files, and you're kind of in the open a ticket world at that point. But you stop Postgres, do a full file system level backup, and keep that backup safe. That, when dealing with serious data corruption, that's one of the first things you want to do, because a lot of the things you might do to fix corruption modify the underlying pages on the disk, and you want to make sure that if that goes wrong, you can go back to a known good state. As you make changes, do them methodically and document each step. The most common kind of corruption, and this is fortunately one that's easily fixed, is index corruption. The easiest thing to do here is just drop the index and the transaction confirms that solves the problem. The queries might be running very slow now because they don't have an index, but at least you'll see the errors go away. And if that proves to be a problem, rebuild the index and you're done. If the errors don't go away without the index, then it's probably not index corruption. Do a PG dump of the whole database. The nice part of PG dump is it reads every row and creates a logically good snapshot, and then restore that into a clean database. Sometimes that doesn't work because you have a bad data page. For example, the checksum fails. You get complaints about errors involving bad headers. Can you do a PG dump of that particular table? In Extrema, you can turn on zero damage pages, which will zero out any page that comes in and is corrupted, doesn't have a proper structure, effectively kicking it out of the database. Any data on that page will be lost, but at least you can now build a better copy of the table. Sometimes you will get really bad data pages. For example, ones that the backend crashes when it tries to read. Can you select around them? If you can, you can do a copy of the good data, drop the table, and copy it back in. Or you can create table from the select that excludes the bad pages and rename the table appropriately. If you can isolate them, you can also just delete the bad rows by CTID. CTID is a hidden column in Postgres that identifies each row uniquely, each row version also, so you can't use it as a primary key. Please don't do that. But you can sometimes isolate particular bad rows and use the delete command, just delete where CTID equals, to get rid of them. Sometimes what you can do to find bad data pages, especially more than one, since a select will just terminate at the first bad page it finds, is you can write a small PLPGSQL function with an exception block around the select and iterate through the rows in the table, logging all the bad ones. This is very helpful for finding toast corruption because you need to go out and access all the long attributes in the table to get, so it decompresses the toast, the appropriate toast external rows. So the problem with a lot of these is you don't know they're going to happen until they do. So the first thing to be is the best thing is to be act defensively and prepare for these unexpected occurrences. The first thing to remember is this stuff can happen to a PostgreSQL installation of any size. So any database although not necessarily will, have some kind of weird problem like this. So the best way to avoid these problems turning into crises is to be prepared for it. Number one thing, test your backups. A backup that tests is not a backup. One thing to do is give them to developers. Use them to prime development systems. Use them for analytics. And make sure the restore steps are automated and foolproof, because if you do have to use a backup to restore a production system, you'll probably have to do it on no sleep. One note about backups is at this stage, it really doesn't make sense to roll your own PITR backup facility. Use one of the solutions that's out there that's been developed and tested by people who really understand this deeply. PG Backrest is my personal favorite. There's also Barman, which is an excellent solution. Don't roll your own backup solution. Backing up Postgres, especially doing file system level backups, not PGNUM, has a lot of gotchas and a lot of corner cases, and you really want to take advantage of years of experience in doing these. Next step is make sure to monitor things. Make sure you alert well before disk space exhaustion. You want to make sure that you see disk space exhaustion coming from months away, not hours. A lot of these problems can be avoided if you just look at your logs. It's very frustrating when we go into a client system and see gigabytes upon gigabytes of logs with errors in them that the client is totally unaware of. And these can be things like application problems, like it's trying to write to a column that doesn't exist, or duplicate key violations. Or it can be warnings that the system is approaching XID wraparound shutdown, and in fact is getting critically close to that. But because they haven't been looking at the logs, they had no idea. So use some kind of log summarization system. If nothing else, there's PG Badger, and a cute little Perl script, which will take logs and produce nice HTML reports for you. And just do that on a daily or weekly basis, and look at the errors tab and see what kind of errors are being thrown. Make sure to track lock weights. By default, Postgres does not log lock weights in the text logs. Set log lock weights equals zero, and just do that on every system, no matter what. If you're getting extremely high log volume because of lock weights, that's a pathology you should know about. You should also track temporary file creation. This could also be a reason for bad I/O or out of disk space, as gigantic temporary files are being created. Set log temp files equals to zero. Similarly to lock weights, if that generates an excessive amount of log volume, that's the problem. Don't turn it off just to ignore the problem. Just do the right kind of backups. Do PITR backups rather than PG dump so you can recover to a particular point in time. And again, don't roll your own. Use PG Backrest or Barman or one of the kinds of things. Test them regularly, because corruption can lurk for an extended period before it's found. You could have corruption on the disk that a file system level backup will just copy the corruption like it copies everything else. But because you just never got to those rows recently, you don't know it's there. Make sure auto vacuum is happening. Check bloat on a periodic basis. Look at PG stat user tables and make sure that the last auto vacuum data is reasonable. Never disable auto vacuum, not for a particular table, not system wide. If you're having auto vacuum problems, fix it for particular tables. Don't just shut off auto vacuum and hope for the best. Monitor query execution time. Frequently, one of the first signs that there are going to be problems is query execution time for common queries is starting to go up unexpectedly. The PG Badger could also be very helpful for this kind of thing. Make sure fsync's on, and make sure this really happens. On a lot of SAN-based systems, fsync isn't really being honored, these kinds of flush operations. The SAN will say, yes, I did a flush, and it actually lied. It's still sitting in some kind of SSD cache. And the argument is, well, the battery backup will take care of that if there's a power failure, which is great, assuming the battery is still charged. Set full page writes equals to on, because very, very few file systems guard against torn pages, and you'll know if you're running on one of a file system that guards against torn pages. So just turn it on. And don't kill -9 anything, especially not the postmaster process. Deploy minor versions as they come out. Postgres does get bugs. They're fixed in minor versions. Some of them are data corruption bugs. And for example, yeah, now you may say, but wasn't the bug at that you talked about at the very start of the presentation introduced in a minor version upgrade? And the answer is yes, it was, but that's extremely uncommon. So don't not upgrade because of that. And plan an upgrade strategy so you're not caught by a major version going end of life. For example, if you're on 9.4, that's out end of life at this point. 9.4 was an extremely popular Postgres release. So my rule of thumb is when a new version drops, plan to upgrade that within the next year and come up with a strategy. Don't get stuck on an ancient version of Postgres. If you have access to the underlying files and you're creating the database cluster yourself, turn on checksums. It's nice because it flags corruption immediately. It doesn't fix the damage, but it does tell you there's a problem. Use it unless your file system does checksums. Most file systems don't do this underlying checksumming. If you're running on ZFS, you know it. One thing that's frequently common is the result of some of these, especially data corruption issues, is you have to build a new database server right away, very quickly. Now, on cloud-based systems, not so much of a problem, but you just push a button and you get a new RDS server. Unfortunately, if there's data corruption issues, the new server can pick that up as well, and at that point you're back to file a ticket time. If you're running your own servers, frequently you'll have to pull another server together very quickly, and this can result in you have to create the same service configuration, including packages, any supporting things, monitoring tools, that kind of stuff. So use a proper configuration management system. Ansible is my favorite. It's Terraform. Terraform and Ansible do different things, but Salt, Puppet, Chef, there are lots of them, but use one of those so you can just push a button and get a new database server provisioned. And test everything. I like to do application level database scans, that is to say things you connect for the client, because tuples get lonely. If you have a 16 terabyte database, I'm sure there are lots of tuples out there that haven't been read in a long, long time. Don't wait for vacuum freeze to scan the whole table, and you can have corruption that happened after the last vacuum freeze. Make this a part of your migration and upgrade strategy to just check everything. You can for example, use pgdump. Okay, let's play a game. So your main data center burns to the ground. How do you get the database back up? What's your plan? Data centers are just buildings. They catch fire like everything else. I live near San Francisco, and data centers here sit on fault lines, so they're going to go away at some point. Find out how you get the database back up, how much data you would lose in this, and AWS regions come offline sometimes, so they're not permanently, but they do. So what's your plan? This kind of disaster planning is very, very enlightening. Have a runbook for these situations. It's very important to have step-by-step instructions, maintain it, keep it up to date, put it in a place people can get at it, make sure that it's not hosted on the same machine that your database is on in case the database server goes away. Sometimes you will have to go off script because you'll be stepping through the runbook and the situation will be a little bit different than you anticipated, but do that, but still have it. But it's important to have a list of things to try and steps to take because you'll be doing this on no sleep. Databases could fail at any time, and for some reason they love to do it at 3 a.m., whenever 3 a.m. is your local time. So I want to close with one last thing because we started with an example of a Postgres bug. So frequently you will think, well, hopefully not too frequently, you will think, I found a Postgres bug. I'd like to fix this, get this Postgres bug fixed, but I am not a C hacker. How do you want to do this? You'll want to interact with the PostgreSQL community to do that. It'll be, it's important to understand the best ways of working with the community. And on the lists, very frequently, I see people reporting bugs and things like that, and I can tell this bug report is going to go nowhere. And a little guidance here might be helpful. The first thing to understand is, if you're crashed into a Postgres bug and it's stopping your work, this is the most important thing to you right now. Your work is stopped, it's a disaster, it might be data corruption, so it's dominating your life. But the community sees these things all the time. And so they will not automatically assign it the same priority you have in your head. So the problem is, if this bug was the worst thing in the world to the developer, they would have pushed a fix already. And pretty much no one is paid just to fix Postgres bugs. There's a lot of commercial support for Postgres, and a lot of companies that include Postgres as part of their community involvement. But just understand, those people don't work for you. They have other things to do. And the people who can hack on Postgres are really busy. So they have lots of other things going on. So it's important to understand how to work with the community to get your particular bug fixed. If you can, develop a test case. A reproducible test case gets these things fixed much faster than anything else in the universe. Document everything, even if you think it's not important. One of the most frustrating parts on bug reports is having to play 20 questions with the submitter, saying, which version are you on? What options did you compile Postgres with? What does your schema look like? What indexes are on this table? And have that ready to go. Very frequently, you'll be running with data that you can't just release to the public. That's life. That's the world, and that's fine. But if you ideally, you should come up with a data anonymization plan so that you build this reproducible test case. Then file a bug. There's a mailing list of file bugs. There's a web form. All the web form does is generate a formatted email that goes to the bugs list. But report it to PG Bugs. You can use the web form. There are guidelines there. Read them. They're very important. The whole community is set up to respond better to bugs that follow these guidelines. And if it's critical, like data corruption or repeated server crash, things like that, consider bringing it up on hackers, but always file a bug. And just remember, everyone's busy with their own crises. If you're having crashing or freezing bugs, with things where the backend seems to freeze or peg CPU and doesn't get any work done, or crashes, core dumps, install the debug packages, get stack traces out of them, use strace to find out where things are hung up, and include that as part of your report. Be persistent, but be polite. If you start a thread about a bug, monitor it. Don't just go away. This is very frustrating when someone files a bug, someone responds saying, looks bad, what about this? And then there's silence for 3 weeks. So keep up with it. If they do ask questions, answer them promptly or thoroughly. And just as an etiquette thing, don't badger the developers. They don't work for you. Everyone understands that if your work is stopped because of this, it's important, but this is free software. So you will have to interact with them on that basis. And even if they do work for you, still be nice. Well-documented, repeatable, critical bugs get fixed pretty fast, like in hours or days. So be of good cheer. You will get solutions, but hold up your end of the bargain. And that's my talk. Thank you very, very much for listening. Thank you to FOSDEM for having me. And I believe now is time for questions.